a sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on September 8, 1985, in the series God, Our Ally, entitled The God Who Blesses Our Homes. The texts for the sermon are Isaiah 58, verses 13 through 14, and Mark 2, verses 27 through 28. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
It's always difficult on this Sunday to make the transition from the first service to the second because the two services are so different. But the message, I think, is something that we can all profit from in terms of our own sense of God's love and grace in our lives and our need to continue to be nurtured in that love and grace, and also in the sense that we all take a vow and make a commitment every time a child is baptized here, and that will be the case this morning. We all commit ourselves to the nurture of the children of the flock. I wish you could have seen the scads of beautiful children this morning as they all came down front and marched out. It's a tremendous treasure that we have and a tremendous responsibility to make sure that they are raised in the atmosphere of God's love and grace. The important thing for those children to know from their earliest years is that God is their ally. The important thing for children from the days of infancy to feel is that God is their ally. God is not our adversary. God is our friend. God is on our side. He's there for us. He loves us with an unconditional love. He'll never let us go. And it's only a question of whether or not we can open ourselves up to that and receive that and then live in the joy and the rest of that. It's very important that the children get the message straight from the beginning. Because later on, we can come to new intellectual conceptuality. We can come to new understanding. But we never really get over those early impressions that are written indelibly on the core of our being. Those early impressions impact us so deeply that even though we may be convinced in our mind that something else may be the case, the old tapes will continue to play, and we will constantly be living in that tension between the new conception that we really believe and the old conception that battles away in the depths of our being that we continue to feel. And so that early nurture is so terribly important. And in this next to the last message of this series that seems never to end, I am going to talk about the response that is called for in terms of the goodness and the greatness of God as we have come to understand Him. Today, the call to nurture, the final one next week, the irrepressible worship that issues forth from our lives when we get the message straight, when we really come to understand who God is, when we really begin to sense and to feel His goodness and His mercy and the depths of His grace. Then one does not have to be coerced into worship. One cannot help worshiping because of the very goodness and grace of God. So, the call to nurture today, the irrepressible worship next week, and then I'll give you a much-deserved rest. God calls us to the nurture of our children, our families. And on this Education Sunday, we want to hear His word that calls us again to pass along that message, to communicate the knowledge of who He is. And this call to nurture comes this morning from the classic Christian education text. It was a classic Jewish education text too. It's the backbone of that Jewish tradition, which has stayed alive through all these centuries and through Holocausts and all hell, because they continued to tell the story and keep the message alive. And we in the Christian church are charged with the same responsibility to keep the good news flowing and to keep telling the story in order that we might understand that our story is incorporated in His story, and that our children may come to see that their story is His story, which is our common history. So, the call to nurture comes right at the point of the confession of Israel's faith, in that brief creedal statement that summed up the essence of what they believed. Sixth chapter of Deuteronomy, the fourth verse, "Hear, O Israel, Yahweh is our God." Our God, Yahweh, is one God. Now, when I grew up, I never knew who Yahweh was. I never heard of Yahweh. I heard of Jehovah. Jehovah doesn't really exist. Jehovah is a mismatch. It's really a hybrid between the vowels of one name and the consonants of another, because the Jews held that name to be so holy that they never pronounced it. So they brought in some other vowels and put them with the consonants of Yahweh. They never said Yahweh, and I never said Yahweh either, but it's important that you hear that word Yahweh, the name of God, because in this core creedal statement, the name of God that is used, Yahweh, communicates volumes that can't be communicated in English translation. Yahweh is really the Hebrew verb to be. And while the etymology of that name is in the deep, dark depths of the past, nonetheless, we can at least trace it biblically to the third chapter of Exodus, where God puts His finger on Moses and He says, "Lead my people to freedom." And Moses says, "Who, me?" He says, "Yes, you." He says, "Who shall I say you are?" He says, "Just tell them, I am that I am." Now that "I am that I am," which God reveals as His name, is the Hebrew verb to be, and it can be variously translated. I am that I am, I will be whom I will be. Some say it has a causative dimension to it. I cause to be whatever exists. Another commentator suggests that maybe God is saying, just tell them, I'll be there for them. The God of being, the God who is, I am who I am, I will be there for you, you can count on me. Now you see, when you say this is the creed of Israel, "Hear, O Israel, God, Yahweh, our God, is one God," you don't get the depths of what's involved in that, but the Yahweh meant the God of Exodus, which was the God of salvation, the God of grace, the God who had set them free. And so when Israel confessed its faith, and its faith in one God, that there was only one God, they said, and that God is Yahweh, that God is a covenant God, that God is a faithful God, that God is a God of grace. So they confessed who God was. And interestingly, it goes on to say, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and mind and soul and strength. Strange that love should be commanded, because love can't be commanded. And yet, Jesus lifted that statement up and said, this is the first and great commandment. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with heart, soul, and strength. To command love is impossible. And yet, if we understand that that command follows the naming of God, Yahweh, then we understand that the command to love was simply a command to be natural, to do that which would come naturally in the light of who God is. If Yahweh is their God, then they will love God. They will not be able not to love their God, because their God is a God who set them free, a God who loves them unconditionally, a God who supports them and sustains them. He is the God of salvation, the God of redemption. He is the God who is the ground of their lives. And therefore, this God, if it is understood that He is such a God, then it is understood as well that He will be loved. And then the call to nurture comes. Let these words be in your heart, and you shall teach them thus and so. Teach them to your children. Teach them diligently in all situations. Pass along this knowledge of this God, because this knowledge will result in the love of God. The call to nurture is a call to communicate this knowledge of God to the rising generation. And there's a double reference here. In the first place, if we're going to nurture our children, there is something in which to nurture them. There's a given content to the faith. We confess that the God whom we worship is the God who revealed Himself in the history of Israel and in the life of Jesus. And we have in the Scriptures the history of Israel and the life of Jesus and that which followed in the wake of the event of Jesus. And so when we say that we are Christian, we say that we are a people who have a certain knowledge of God that has been revealed to us. Revealed to us in His action in history. We speak of God in terms of what He has done. Now, to be a Christian is not simply to have some kind of sentimental religious feelings. I suppose all people have some kind of sentimental religious feelings sometimes. I mean, a sunset or a baby's cry. And then someone feels moved in the depths of their being, and we might say that's a kind of a religious emotion. But to be Christian is to have a certain given content to which one is oriented. It is to confess the truth of a certain history in which God revealed Himself. It is to confess the God who revealed Himself in a certain history. Not just any God. Not just any knowledge. Not just any feeling. Not just any philosophical idea. Not just any religious system. To be Christian is to be bound to the book. And then, of course, this book is already the interpretation, faith's interpretation of that history. But then beyond that, we've got 2,000 years of Christian tradition. And so, to be Christian is to have a certain given tradition, a biblical tradition and the church tradition. And you put all of that together, and that's a certain content. And it's important that that story be told. Your children are not going to, any more than you, will just sort of, through osmosis, soak up this knowledge and this truth out of the air. It doesn't come out of the blue. There is a certain content that needs to be communicated, and in order to communicate it, it has to be taught with devotion and with commitment. You remember that one of the things that struck me most in Europe, in my European pilgrimage a little over a year ago, was the comment of my professor, Professor Berkoff, who said, "I don't even have any point of contact with a rising generation in the Netherlands today." He said, they have no frame of reference. There is no point of orientation. They have nothing from which to get their bearings. They don't even know what the questions are. Now, they have as much spiritual hunger and they have as much restless anxiety as any other human being. But his point was that he felt helpless in communicating with them because they were not able to put their finger on that which they were reaching after and grasping for. And then he said to me, you remember, "This generation are not the prodigals. They are the sons and daughters of the prodigals." And you can understand that. Because a prodigal can leave home. A prodigal can say goodbye to the father. A prodigal can go into the far country. And he can spend his life in riotous living or whatever, but a prodigal is one who still knows that there is a home and there is a father, and if he ever comes to himself, he knows he can go back home and he can find again the father. But what if the prodigal has a child out in the far country? And he never tells the child about the father. He never tells a child about home. The child has that yearning, which we all have, for home. And doesn't even know how to identify it. The story needs to be kept alive. The story needs to be told. There is a given content to the faith. But when we've passed along the content, when we have told the story, we haven't done it all. It's not a matter of simply imparting head knowledge, but rather this knowledge must be communicated from heart to heart. If we went on in that chapter, we would have found that Moses says to them, in years to come, when your son says to you, why do you do these funny things? Why do you take bread? Why do you drink that cup? Why do we have a Passover dinner? Why do we keep this festival and that feast? Then tell them, we were slaves in Pharaoh's land, and God set us free and delivered us. The teaching, the telling of the story, is through the manner or the method of testimony or of witness. The communication of knowledge is not simply the inculcation of intellectual content. It is the penetration of the heart with knowledge of the heart that bears that personal dimension that not only God loves us, but God loves me. I have tasted and I have seen that the Lord is good. Christian teaching, Christian nurture in school, in the church, in the family home has a certain given data to be passed along. But it is all important that it is passed along in the sense of testimony, of bearing witness to grace. When your son asks you, then tell him, we were slaves and God set him free. When your child asks you, tell him about Jesus. Tell him about his death and his life and his coming again. Tell him about the grace that has come to us through Jesus Christ. So the task of Christian nurture, which is charged to all of God's people, has that double reference of communicating content and also of bearing witness to the grace that is in Christ Jesus. And the text says it's got to be done diligently. It's a word that is used for sharpening arrows so that the arrow will be deeply embedded in the enemy or the heart of the target. To teach diligently is to teach in such a way that the teaching will penetrate through the defenses and through the barriers and penetrate to the core of the being. Christian nurture is not optional. Christian nurture is not nonchalant. It is not something about which we can be blasé. It is not fun and games. It is deadly serious. It is to penetrate to the core of the being in order that the child or the adult feels the love of God, which is the heart of the message. Love the Lord your God with heart, soul, and mind, and let these words be in your heart and speak of them. Teach them diligently to your children. Teach them and be everlastingly at it. Teach them when you're indoors. Teach them when you're out of doors. Teach them when you're sitting up, when you're lying down, when you're going along the way. In other words, structure formal times when they will be taught. And then capture the moments, those moments when they are open and vulnerable, when you can capture that moment to speak to them about the love of God in Jesus. Take every opportunity. Be always alert, always aware, always ready. Whether it be in the formal situation or the informal relationship, but let it all be to the end that the goodness and the grace and the mercy of God may be communicated to the child, that it may penetrate to the very core and the heart of their life and their being. And do it with manuals and with Bible study, and do it with all of the resources that are available in the Christian church. Do it with drama and do it with ritual. Hit the mind and hit them in that intuitive perception that comes not through the intellectual propositions of the faith, but rather through the sense of the feeling of the depths and the reality of the grace of God in Jesus Christ. And let me point to that for just a moment. We've had a Passover supper here on occasion during the Holy Week. And you, some of you have participated in that, and you know how all the family was included. Now in the Old Testament, the children were given the sign of initiation into that covenant community. The sign of circumcision was the Old Testament initiatory sign or rite. And then the children as well were included in that commemorative ceremony of the Passover, which was the very heart of their celebration annually of their freedom and their deliverance from the bondage of Egypt. And various members of the family were assigned various parts. The youngest children read a prayer and waited for the prayer looking for Elijah. The youngest child had a part. And what do you think it said to that young child? How do you think that young child felt when he was included in that family circle that was celebrating the greatest night of their national history? That child not only learned through his mind and through the perception of the intellectual content of what was going on, he not only heard the story, he felt that he was the story. For in that annual celebration, it was to reenact and to relive in order that every generation could say, we were there that night that God set us free. And where religious drama and religious ritual is properly carried out, it is the reliving and the reenactment so that every succeeding generation will be able to say, yes, I was there when they crucified my Lord. So that every one of us will not feel this long distance, but rather intimately a part of the story, knowing that our story is a part of His story, which is history. And now in the enactment of that in the Jewish family, the old covenant came to life. And then in the early church, the same practice was followed. The same practice was followed in the early church for several centuries, where a child or an adult came and was baptized. And then eventually the bishop, in the rise of that office, laid on hands and prayed for the Spirit. And then following the laying on of hands and the prayer for the Spirit, communion was offered. And in the early church for centuries, that was the custom. Communion followed baptism, which was the gift of the Spirit of God, and the laying on of hands was simply the prayer to formalize that, and the children with the adult were invited to the table. It's interesting that it was about 1215 in the Fourth Lateran Council when the children were forbidden to come to the table. Not until 1215. And you know why they were forbidden? They were forbidden because two developments. For one thing, with the growth of sacerdotalism, you know that word? Sacerdotalism, that's what we don't believe here. That is that there is a priestly caste that through the rite of ordination has a special grace to do something that everybody else can't do. We don't believe that. I don't have any powers to do anything that you can't do. There is no separation between laity and clergy in our conception of things. But that developed in the medieval church. And in that development, with a priestly class developing, and then hierarchically the office of the bishop, what happened is that the local priest could baptize and could give communion, but could not lay hands on for confirmation and the gift of the Spirit. And so baptism and confirmation were separated. The one would happen locally. The child would be baptized. The child would be given communion. And when the bishop came around, the child would have hands laid on him. But while that priestly development was happening, there was another theological development, the understanding of the sacrament. And in the 13th century, the sacrament was elevated so high that they began to feel that they had to keep children away from the table. The development of the doctrine of transubstantiation that teaches that the bread becomes the body of Christ, literally, physically, and that the wine becomes the blood of Christ. I could read you from the monastic constitutions of the 9th century a paragraph that would say that if a drop of wine were spilled on this carpet, we'd have to rip the carpet up and take it and put it away in the sacristy. If a crumb of the bread were dropped, it was a desecration of the body. If an officiant, a priest, officiating at the table should do such a thing, he was subject to severe penalty and punishment. It's really a horror story to read what happened with the development of the sacrament in those medieval times. And consequently, a lot of people didn't even come to communion. They didn't want to profane the sacrament, and of course, children were forbidden. Because kids spill things. It's as simple as that. And with that development, this invitation to come and to sit at the family meal was forbidden. The children of the covenant, contrary to our best understanding of children in the covenant of grace. Well, at the time of the Reformation, sacerdotalism was done away with. And also, the view of the sacrament was modified. But the one thing John Calvin never did was to take the next logical step and say, and then on that basis, let the children come. It would have been the logical and reasonable response to his other understanding of the sacrament and of the nature of ministry. But he never took the next step. He might have taken that step if he hadn't been attacked by the Anabaptists who believed in the rebaptism of those who had been baptized in infancy and who said to him, you ought to do away with infant baptism. He said, no, I will not do away with infant baptism. It is a sign and seal of grace. It is a means of grace. Thereby God communicates His Spirit, and he made this big argument for keeping infant baptism. And they said to him, that's unreasonable to keep that and forbid children to come to the table. And they were right, and Calvin was wrong. And the Reformation tradition has been wrong for 450 to 500 years. Because what we have done in barring children from the table is to say that you are part of the family, but not quite. Now, children don't understand that intellectually, but they can feel that. I mean, what did that little child feel in the Hebrew family on Passover night when he shared the meal with brothers and sisters and mother and father, when he read the prayer and the scripture and was caught up into the drama so that he knew that his story was a part of the story? He sensed more than he understood intellectually. He could intuit, he could take it into the core of his being that this was his drama. I can remember one Sunday coming home from church after communion and saying to my dad, when can I partake? And I remember that he had a tear in his eye. That's where I get emotional instability. The question moved him. It moved him because he saw there probably the first beginning spiritual inclinations, and he perhaps thought he had a precocious spiritual giant on his hands, you know. All I was just a kid wanting a piece of bread. But he read much more into it. But what kind of body language do we communicate when we do not pass it to the child, but pass it over the child? When in the Hebrew Old Covenant, the child was a part and parcel of it all, and for us, the child is excluded. Through that body language, through that ritual enactment, and we've missed the most powerful, potent impact in the life of the child possible by welcoming them to the family feast, to the festival which need not be protected, which need not somehow or other be fenced off, but needs to be offered. It is the offering of Jesus saying, this is my body, this is my blood. Don't treat it with disrespect, but don't treat it as though somehow or other it's some kind of magical or superstitious stuff. It is by that you can remember, and by that I will feed you and I will give you grace. But open it up to the children that they may know that they are part with us in the family of God, in the covenant of grace. And that's why some years ago we We opened it up at Christ Community. Our theological commission in the Reformed Church has recommended it now for a number of years, but the church as a whole is not ready for it. And they've turned it down at General Synod. But I can never wait for General Synod to do it. If it's right, it's right. And it is so right. I mean, what happens even when we are adults? What's really effective? What if we are talking about our faith? And I'm talking with you and I draw the line here. And I invite you to step over that line and join me. I may be ever so genuine about the fact that it is only by God's grace and God's gift that I should have this understanding and be here. But still in all, I'm saying to you, I'm in and you're out. Step over the line. What happens? Oh, if we understand anything about human nature, we know what happens. The defenses rise. The resistance begins to build in. What happens if instead of drawing the line here between us, we draw a circle around us? What happens then if we talk about the grace of God? What happens then if we can say to one another, all that awaits is for us to open our eyes and realize that which is already true. The only thing for us to do is simply accept that which has already been provided by that one who loved us from all eternity. What happens if we draw the circle to include us all in order that we might all join hands and hearts and celebrate the grace of God that loves us with an unconditional love and that will never let us go? What would happen if the church would dare to proclaim that kind of radical love and that kind of radical grace that would include all of those who wish they could come but feel unworthy? What would happen if we could say, you are already included because Christ has died for our sin, and not for ours only, but for the sin of the whole world? Then just open your life, open your heart, open your eyes, and receive that which is the deepest reality and the most profound truth. And you see, I give you this history of the supper just as an illustration of what we've always done with the church. Always sort of kept folks at arm's length. Always tried to protect that. Always tried to protect him when he says, why don't you just let it loose? Why don't you share it? Why don't you embody it? Why don't you incarnate it so that people will feel it? Then my love and my grace will become tangible. And then the purpose of nurture will be realized. For how can you help but loving a God like that? Heart and soul and mind and strength. How can you help, if the message is clear, how can you help but love a God like that? I used to say on those rare occasions, every once in a while, not very often, but now and again, when someone would come out and say, great sermon, I'd say, humble me, thank God. And then I grew up a little bit and I used to look them in the eye and say, thank you. Figuring that was the simplest way to respond. You know what I feel now? I feel that I could really honestly say, yeah, it's a great message. It's a great message. Because it's simply the setting forth such a great truth. It's a great truth. It's a marvelous truth. It's a kind of a truth that once understood could hardly be turned down. It's almost too good to be true. Thanks be to God.